Welcome to the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris. Wanted to do a debrief on the Southern Baptist Convention meeting in Orlando, Florida. And I have my brother with me, David. He was a messenger to the convention this year. And it's the day after everything's happened. And between the two of us, we were at the entire convention because I arrived yesterday afternoon and I got to see the last little bit of it with the resolutions and the report from NAM. And the transfer of the former president, Clint Pressley, to Willie Rice, the new president of the convention. And you were there pretty much for all the important stuff. So I'm going to let David talk about a little bit what he saw. And we'll give our impressions of the meeting, how it went, and maybe what could go better or worse for next year, some ideas. So why don't you start? This was your first year as a messenger there, and you are a member of a Southern Baptist church. What surprised you about the convention? Did anything catch you off guard that you thought you had it one way in your head and it wasn't that way? Or,
I mean, I didn't really, like, we didn't grow up Southern Baptist. So, I mean, we have Southern Baptist in our family, if you go back a ways, but we grew up more in the Masters IFCA world. So I had never been to anything that big. So I feel like the first thing when I walked into the, I guess some of my, the things I guess that impressed me are just going to be the general stuff from never having been at anything like that before. But it's massive. I was told the largest business meeting in the world. From a few people said that. I don't know if that's true, but really, really big. And when you walked into the auditorium, I was like, oh, I mean, it seems pretty big. And then I looked at how far away the people on the stage were, and it looked like you were on a mountain looking off into the distance. They were so far away. So very big. And then when I walked into the exhibitor hall, also just massive, and you have all the seminaries, and they have these really, like, fancy-looking displays and everything. And my first thought was, like, maybe this is what Luther thought when he went to Rome, and he saw, like, all the extravagance of Rome, which I'm not saying that, you know, there was plenty of good stuff there, but, you know, it was just very, very over the top compared to what anything that I'm used to. But in some ways, I feel like walking into it, now I kind of understand a little bit better the impact of the SBC, kind of why these things matter, and the political process of it. Because a lot of denominations, I mean, there's a lot of independent churches, especially in the United States now, and just kind of seeing how it works, and that there's sort of my thought was kind of, this is like the United States, but on a somewhat micro level, where you have like these different coalitions coming together and trying to achieve outcomes that are somewhat political, but it requires a lot of work and a lot of, like, in some ways political capital. But I also just, I guess I happened to go on the right year, because from what I was told by people I know that were there, a lot of the Southern Baptist Convention, kind of after, when it's done, there's a lot of, oh, it didn't go our way again. And this time, everybody was so happy. They're all, like, rejoicing and everything. Yeah. And I was like, oh, something good must have, I guess this is really good. And when I was leaving, I was like, well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I guess it's a big deal, but how big of a deal? And then I was looking at X, and I'm seeing, like, CNN is reporting on, and all these media, media organizations are reporting on. I was like, okay. Now it's starting to make more sense. So as somebody who is completely outside of this world and just very recently stepped into it, I've only been a Southern Baptist for about a year, and I only last minute decided to go to the convention because I happened to be in Orlando at the same time, it made a lot of things make more sense to me.
Yeah, well, Southern Baptist roots go back to the formation of the convention, and it was our dad who got out of it during the liberal years, at the time the conservative resurgence was happening. He went the other way and didn't want to deal with he grew up in Southern Baptist churches, but didn't want to deal with things like, I think for him, Darwinian evolution was the big deal, and then textual criticism, and ended up in the more MacArthur camp. But I wanted to get us back into the Southern Baptist Convention, or at least for my family, which is part of the reason I went to Southeastern, and I really liked Al Mohler, but then I saw all the woke stuff, and it didn't seem to be going away. It seemed systemic. And so from the point I started covering stuff very closely in 2019 and publicly to now, there's been a lot of changes. And it was a really good feeling this year. I kind of came after the battle, I felt like. Like, things had already been fought. There was some resolutions that people had a tug of war over, but the big battles have been fought, meaning getting Willie Rice elected, that was the big thing. And then also this amendment, the Truth and Unity Amendment to the Southern Baptist Constitution, so that friendly cooperation was further defined as churches with an office and function of a male pastor and not females. So that was, I think, 70% of the convention voted for
over
that.
Over 70.
It was over 70. And for Willie Rice, it was almost 60.
Yeah.
Percent.
And the energy in the room, I was in the room for both of those votes. The energy for Willie, because I'm in my mind, I'm just thinking, okay, this is the thing where every year people go and conservatives go, and then they're always let down, and this is just like a perpetual letdown. That's what I'm expecting in my head. But there were two guys that spoke before the voting. One was, they were stumping for their candidates, and the gentleman, I don't remember his name, I wish I could remember it right now, but there was a black gentleman who, like, you could feel the energy in the room shift when he began to talk. I don't know if you saw his thing, but
I haven't seen his speech. I heard about it.
I'm just thinking about kind of the rhetoric of the two speeches, and I've heard positive things about both of them, but the first guy was kind of appealing to Josh is, he's a Southern Baptist, and his daddy was a Southern Baptist, and his granddaddy was a, and it was very much like, his pants are Southern Baptist, his tie is Southern Baptist, if you cut him, he bleeds Southern Baptist. And then people clapped and everything, and then the black gentleman got up to stump for Willie Rice, and he had his voice was a cross between Vody Bachum and Morgan Freeman. It was like extreme, just boomed across the auditorium, and he goes, "Let me tell you about Willie Rice." And he's like, "Willie Rice is gonna stand when others are gonna fall. Willie Rice," and you could feel the energy just kind of, I don't know if it shifted, but I do know that there were people that didn't know who they were going to vote for, and then that pushed them. So
yeah,
I think there's a lot of people. One of the things that I begin to understand better being at the convention is there's a lot of people who attend the convention who really don't do, a lot of them probably don't even get the chance to do a lot of pre-homework on what exactly is,
They're not listening to my podcast.
They're not listening to your but, they're kind of just waiting to see, like, okay, what's this guy going to say? What's this guy going to say? And then they're making their decision there. And, and a lot of these people, I think, are very busy. There's, I'm not necessarily excusing that, but I'm saying a lot of these, especially pastors, have a lot on their plate. So they get there, and then what the people say once you're there is going to sway them one way or the other. And this guy just, like, really kind of brought down the house, I thought, for Willie Rice. And then they voted, and I could tell, like, the clapping, there was a lot more clapping after that guy. And the energy in the section that I was in, which was the back left, there was, a small handful of people that, weren't clapping, but pretty much everybody seemed like they were there to vote for Willie Rice. Yeah. So that's the sense that I got. And then with the next, yesterday morning, it was even more so with the Truth and Unity Amendment. That seemed, I almost felt like it was universal. And
there was still 30% that, almost, that voted against it.
You could kind of pick them out.
Yeah, the progressives, you could see them.
They didn't look happy.
Yeah.
There's some people there that just didn't look very happy, but most people seemed pretty happy. The mood was very positive. My feeling, I was like, man, if it's like this uplifting every year, how would it go over?
Two things I know I wanted to hit. One, was this actually a conservative victory, which I think most people understand it to be, including the media. I think it was Baptist News Global. Normally, it's a leftist publication, in my opinion, but they actually had a good headline saying that this was the first time a reform candidate had won, I think, in over 30 years. And the other thing to talk about is how, if this is a true conservative victory, or reform victory, if you want to frame it that way, I think they're the same thing at this point. How did this happen? What were the factors? You brought up one, meaning the stump speeches. But there were some people online that had some, sourness about it there. I don't even want to say their names, to be honest with you, but I noticed on X there were some people who had been involved in previous fights in the SBC who were not happy about this for really one major reason. Willie Rice used to be on the more woke side, and this wasn't even that long ago that he was doing panels with black people, asking them about the black experience. He wrote a blog, I know, about January 6th that's been taken down, that I went in on when it happened, because it was condemning the people who were there in unfair ways. And then Al Mohler, obviously having a history of flip-flopping on different matters. For example, same-sex attraction, the Me Too movement, and what constitutes abuse. Even the purpose, he shifted his language on the purpose that the Southern Baptist Convention itself formed. He used to talk a lot more about racism and slavery, and now he's talking about more ministry-related things. I mean, there's a whole handful of things that he's kind of flipped on. Abortion, should women be punished for an abortion, right? And so because of that, and because he's also given credence to woke seminary professors and said woke things himself, there's a mistrust of him, which is totally understandable. And I share that to some extent. I think he's a political operator in many ways. But is it good that he was the one that proposed this amendment and it won? Was that a win for Al Mohler? Was that a resurrection of his conservative bona fides so that he can now lead more? And with Willie Rice, was he just pulling one over on us, pretending to be a conservative? So real quick, since I've been watching both of these guys from a distance, but also I've been looking at all their publicly available information, and Willie Rice has done what many people failed to do, including Al Mohler. Willie Rice actually apologized for backing the wrong crowd, believing the wrong things, pushing the wrong stuff. And that humility to me is huge. It's been a few years since he said anything that I would consider more on the left. And he's made everything I would expect to see from someone who actually shifted positions, he has done. He has backed Center for Baptist Leadership. He's associated with William Wolfe. I've had some nice private messages with him. He's very gracious. And I know just from private interaction, which has been very limited, but I've seen enough to know this guy believes what he's saying. In ways that other people who have told me that they're with me, they are supporting things that I'm supporting, they don't follow through. And I've seen Willie Rice follow through. And he's done everything that I would expect someone to do who's actually shifted their position. And his sermon, I thought, because I did watch that from the pastor's conference, was phenomenal. It was exactly what the Southern Baptists needed to hear. It was somewhat of a rebuke. It was a call back to the right things, and if there's anything that the conservatives in the SBC need, it's pastors at the helm who have a spiritual lioness quality. Because I've noticed for the last few years, it's been kind of the political nerds, the policy wonks, the podcasters who have been calling for reform and trying to, including myself, trying to help people understand what's going on. And I had many people, I just had person after person coming up to me saying how much my podcast has meant, how it helped them. Even a guy come up and say, man, I thought you were a bad guy, and then I actually started listening to you and reading your stuff and like fully on board. So, I mean, this audience has done a lot, but I knew that it couldn't be a podcast thing. It couldn't be a policy wonk thing or a political nerd thing. It had to come from, like the first conservative resurgence did, pastors who had conviction, who could root everything that they were doing back into a love for Jesus Christ and his word, and also fulfilled the quality of being a pastor, that had that spiritual leadership and that gravitas. And Willie Rice had it. Like, that. Were you in the room for that sermon or no?
No, I missed. I came just after when I came. So I went back and listened to it. And
yeah,
this is the guy.
I've never seen that. I mean, and there's been good guys who have run for president. I've never seen that kind of delivery that was so clear, unmistakable, if you know what's going on in Southern Baptist politics, what he was talking about. And he kept the main thing the main thing. And if there's going to be any hope for a conservative victory long term, because this is the beginning, you're going to need a victory next year and the year after, and you're going to have to keep the momentum going, you need guys like him at the helm who aren't just in it for the political reasons, but they're actually people who do real ministry, and they can connect what they're doing on the political level, and I mean Southern Baptist political level, to the actual nuts and bolts stuff. And I think he was able to do that for a few reasons. And this gets into now why they won. He was in Florida. That's his home turf. This is outside of kind of, if you think of the Southern Baptist Convention as mob bosses, you have like the Mohler sort of Kentucky guys. You have the Ezel, Greer, North Carolina guys. You have whatever's left of the Page Patterson Alliance, the CBN folks. And then you have whatever was going on in Florida, which was kind of off the radar. And those guys were fairly supportive of Willie Rice. So he had that advantage. Also, he was able to connect the heart. He was able to connect Southern Baptist normies, meaning the people you describe, rank and file, they're showing up, making a decision on the fly based on what they hear. they care about missions, souls getting saved, ministry. They want to hear about success stories and the advance of the kingdom. If you speak that language, if you're just someone who's like souring on, hey, these guys are telling you they're doing that, but they're not, you're probably not going to gain the same hearing as someone who goes in there and has a positive political message that they can connect to the heart of the Southern Baptist normies and say, you guys who are here for ministry, let me tell you about what I believe is good for ministry. And I think Willie Rice really tapped into that because he was talking about Christ, he was talking about the ministry, and that was his heart. It wasn't about winning something that's technically correct or is more politically on the right or is better for our country nationally speaking. He was really just about the kingdom of God in his sermon. And I thought that was tremendous. Because you look at like even the report, I stayed for Kevin Ezell's, you weren't there, but the North American Mission Board report, and you probably saw it with other reports. It's like listening to ESPN when they're talking about sports stats. Like he's framing everything. Like you could frame what's going on in the North American Mission Board very poorly, or you could frame it very positively depending on what stats you choose to focus on. So he said something like, well, in the last 3 years, we've had baptism growth. Okay, so post-COVID, there's been baptism growth. Is that a surprise for anyone? That we'd obviously think there'd be, like with what we're recording, post-COVID, there should be some growth because everything came to a standstill in 2020 and 2021. So you'd think 2022, 2023, 2024, 2025, of course you're going to see growth. So he goes, we've had 3 years of growth in baptisms. We haven't had that since like 1947. Meaning we haven't had consecutive years of growth. And you're like, you're looking at it, you're like, well, yeah, but if you look at the circumstances of this, it's we reached back to 2017 numbers is what we've done. That's good, but is that really, like the way he frames it is so, it makes it sound way bigger. And then he has these like emotional stories and he really made, it just connects to the heart of the Southern Baptists who want to see missions and ministry. Like he's saying, that's what we're doing. And you look at that as someone who is analyzing the numbers, analyzing what he's actually done, and you're thinking, oh, he's pulling one over on him. You know, this is a rah-rah kind of electioneering, it's a stump speech for the North American Mission Board is what this is. This isn't neutral, but that's how they, I think, keep control is by pacifying people into thinking, like, we're just about the mission, forget about the waste over here. So all that
went on, I would say I saw some of that. I figured that dynamic would be there. I had never seen it in person, but I'm kind of sitting there just thinking rhetorically, like, what is this guy doing? And some of the people who are more ingrained in the bureaucracy, the president of the executive committee, for example, the way that they will kind of get everybody around that room to be saying amen, 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 is it seems like it's always a, well, look at missions, look at missions, look at, don't look over there, look at missions. And I think it works on a lot of people, but if you think about it for a second, it's like, well, why can't we do both? Like, why can't we fight this battle for orthodoxy while also we're going to do the mission stuff no matter what? That's basically, the Southern Baptist Convention is basically a giant missions organization, essentially, in a way, because that's kind of the number one thing that you do is you grow churches and you send out missionaries. And it was red herrings. It was throwing red herrings out, you know, why are we, but then like when they'll shift to like abuse, suddenly that red herring goes away. And because you could do the same thing with abuse. You could say like, why are you so worried about the abuse happens all over the place. Look at how many missionaries we sent out. So it's like, It seems like the progressives or even the progressives who are a little bit more incognito will use the missions component as a red herring to throw out when they don't want you to focus on something that's going on that might be a little bit more sketchy. And then suddenly that completely evaporates when they want to address, we have a problem with abuse.
Well, I saw that at Southeastern when I was a student there. Because I noticed the progress, like when it came to the professors, I knew which ones were more progressive and which ones were more conservative. And the conservatives were generally about actual ministry. And they didn't want to be bothered with the politics of stuff. And that was a disadvantage in a way because the progressives were all about politics. That's what they wanted to do. That's what made them get up in the morning. They wanted to go change these institutions to be more politically progressive. And they would put that as number one and theology and ministry as number two. But when it came time to market that to the Southeastern Society or to members of the Southern Baptist Convention and committee reports, all of a sudden everything's about ministry, everything's about what great things are happening. And then you feel like a jerk if you're the one that has to raise your hand and say, actually, Kevin Ezell, we lost more churches in the last 3 years than we gained. We are actually diminishing in numbers of churches. And he's up there saying, hey, since 2010, we have planted this many churches, gospel preaching churches, where any man can walk in and hear the gospel preached. Well, how many did we lose? He doesn't tell you that part of it. And if you start to ask the question, then they get mad at you. So I've seen this dynamic since I've been in seminary. And it strikes me as a disadvantage for conservatives, because the conservative leaders, when they start to bring up problems, they don't know how to do it in a way to speak the language of the normies in the convention. They start not talking about ministry as much as they're talking about forensic audits and technically right ethical positions, which we should talk about, but they don't connect it usually. And the progressives are great at connecting all of their policies to somehow, like, this is the heart of Jesus and the Imago Dei for the sojourner or for, like, abuse victims or something. They're always connected because that's the language the normies speak. But the dirty secret is, it is the opposite of that. Like, that's the rhetoric part. The heart part, from my observations, seeing this up and close and personal for years, has been the progressives are actually the ones that don't care as much about ministry as their political agenda in general. And the conservatives are the ones that don't want to be bothered with the politics of it. And they're content to let the progressives do a few political things if they can just do ministry. And I suppose there could be a danger. I don't think we're there, but there could be a danger if the conservatives want to do the same kind of thing where...
Could happen.
Yeah, you could go the other direction where it's like, we're just going to be like rah-rah for conservative stuff, but we lose the heart of the ministry, and we're doing this for Christ and for the advance of his kingdom. You have to, which is why I'm positive about Willie Rice. You need both. You need someone who's saying, if you love me, you keep my commandments. Here's what Jesus has said that connects to real policies in our convention and socially. And also at the same time, let's speak the language of missions. I think that came together this year, and that's part of the reason Willie Rice won. Home turf advantage, connecting the heart and soul. Also the work that we've done and Center for Baptist Leadership has done. Church Reform Initiative, the documentary that I just made with them about the female pastors. I mean, we've been uncovering example after example after example since January of female pastors. And that, I mean, putting that on Facebook, putting that on X, that made a big difference.
Yeah, you still had people who went up to the microphone and said, there are no female pastors and nobody
they just
is
look
preaching.
Foolish.
Nobody is preaching. There are no females preaching. Like, nobody is doing what you're saying that they're doing. This isn't a threat. This isn't a...
Yeah, well, that's why we put it out on Friday. And I had guys coming up to me thanking me for that documentary. I mean, I don't know how many people in the room watched it, but quite a few. And I think it did push the needle. It made people realize this is a real problem. We featured 12 churches. We don't know how many. I mean, it takes a lot of manpower to really go through every church in the convention, but there's estimates that it could be as many as 1,800. And the real test was the last few years, the Law Amendment, the Sanchez Amendment. These things failed, and those criticizing Mueller now have to realize he's just stepping into something that's already been ongoing. He's not like, this isn't like his idea. In fact, he was one of the ones early on who was saying there wasn't a problem. So, yeah, of course, someone with his position, he's using that to forward a movement that he did not create. This is already in existence, and if anything, he's late to the show. And maybe he's from an opportunistic perspective, and I'm sure he has convictions on this too, but he is stepping in at the 11th hour when there's already been a lot of momentum built. And so I don't say the amendment is wrong because Mueller was the one that was behind it. You have to look at it on its merits. And if there really is a conservative, I think, movement that's starting to...
Hey, it's John. I've been using Marsmen for a few months now, and I honestly can say that I feel pretty good. I'm not dragging through workouts. I'm not wiped out after chasing my little girl or handling stuff around the house. As a husband and a father, I take it seriously. I want to stay strong, energized, and capable for my family. Marsmen makes that easier. It's packed with 8 powerful, clinically dosed ingredients like Pongkat Ali, Chilajit, Fenugreek, Taurine, Zinc, Boron, Vitamin D, and Vitamin K that work together to support natural testosterone, energy, strength, and recovery. Most guys don't realize it until it hits them, but during the middle age years, you start to lose some of your testosterone. Right now, listeners get a great deal. 50% off for life, free shipping, three free gifts, plus their 90-day higher T guarantee. Go to mengotomars.com and grab yours today. And don't forget to let them know that Conversations That Matter sent you. God bless.
Gain more and more momentum, then this could be used in a not a loophole way, but in a way that we can actually even get more stuff through that will help on that issue and other issues. But here's the test. Next year, we, Southern Baptist, so you,
yeah.
I don't know if I'll be there, but they're going to be, and I think it's, where is it?
It's going to be in Indianapolis.
Indianapolis. And that's not conservative home turf. It's out of the way. It's inconvenient to get to. It's not a hub. And, where are you going to fly in? Chicago?
Indianapolis.
From a
well,
connecting
I'm thinking
flight.
Here, it is kind of the heart. It's not far from Nashville. It's not far from Kentucky. It's not like it's, it could be worse. It could be in California, which.
It's going to be more, it's on the border of Kentucky, and that's like Moeller's crew. So it's going to have a lot of insiders at Louisville, probably, and Nashville, you know, ERLC guys and so forth showing up. That, I mean, this is what I heard conservatives saying, who are know more probably than I do about this. And they were saying, look, next year is going to be a test. Florida is a different ball game. Can we do this? Can we sustain this momentum next year? And if they can, then that's going to be, I think, the real test.
We're going to win.
Yeah, well, people ask me, like, well,
said we couldn't do it, but we did it.
They said, John, why are you here? Like, what? And I was like, I booked the tickets when I knew we were going to win. And they're like, well, when did you know we were going to win? And I said, actually, I was pretty strongly suspicious that we were going to win in October. And the reason was because of some of the things I've said, but also the ERL season disarray. Willie Rice was the preferred pick for the progressives, just maybe 2021, 2022. He knows where the skeletons are buried. They can't, like, the first time that he received actual pushback was the Baptist 21 lunch this year. Like, they didn't do to him what they did to Mike Stone. His personality is also very agreeable and just, I mean, he's a nice guy. Like,
he seems like a classic Southern Baptist too, and like, in the best way, I would say.
I knew that he was gonna run before he announced. I had heard it through the grapevine, and I could see what was happening at the RLC. I could see that they didn't have any racially charged amendments last year. I was like, I think we're winning. We're gonna win.
Like, reading through the resolutions, there was, because I had seen blurbs of some of them, but then actually being there on Monday and reading through all of them, some of them there was language, and I know that's very political how those resolutions are put together. And you know, we want this phrase in there, and we want this phrase, and then they'll actually amend it like on the spot, or they'll change, like, I think there was in the Charlie Kirk one, it said toxic, and they changed it to sinful.
They did.
So there's things like that, and that goes on. And that makes sense. That's like how you do business there. But even the one on immigration, like, I was kind of reading through it, and that's like my issue. It's like my only issue.
Did you like it or no?
Well, that's the thing. So I'm reading through it, and I'm like, okay, what is this? And then I got towards the end of it, and it said, we reject amnesty for basically any crimes committed. So, like, we reject amnesty. It was like a rejection of amnesty. I was kind of like, oh, I would probably vote for this just based on that alone. Just the Southern Baptist Convention opposed amnesty. I still don't know, because
I'm
there's
suspicious.
Some language in there. And any statement on when they start going into the, but we support, you know, the humane treatment of, and like, what do you mean? Are you saying that what ICE is doing is like inhumane? Like,
well, what was that article? Exactly? You wrote one on the, what was this Salazar's thing?
Maria Salazar, well, the Dignidad.
But they said in the act, like, oh, this is an amnesty. Remember
that? It's amnesty.
Because that's the progressive play right now. It's like, oh, we're not for amnesty. Like, you'll never get anyone
and
on record.
And then you get them talking, and you just, so what are you for? And then, like,
it's
5 minutes later, you're like, okay, so amnesty. So
with
you're for
steps.
Amnesty.
Yeah.
Because even the fees that you would have to pay for that were almost nothing. It was like $1,000 a year, I think, or something like that. I don't remember the specific number.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was just straight up amnesty.
They're like, we'll put a tax on it and call it not amnesty, but it is. And that was the concern I had looking at it. I'm like, you got to put tight language in there about that. And the thing I really didn't like was they said that nativism was against the Imago Dei.
Yeah.
They pitted those against each other. And if you look up like a dictionary definition of nativism, it just means preference for your people in your local region.
Well, native, it's just kind of something you throw at people to make them It's like if you don't want to say racist, but you say nativist.
Yeah. Like I prefer the people that live near me than to the people that live far away from me, and I want them to reap the benefits of what we're all working towards here. That's just a normal thing. I was talking to someone about this. I was like, you know, the resolutions to me, a lot of them, when they have to do with public policy things, I don't know why the Southern Baptist Convention is even talking about it. Like, the Southern Baptist Convention should be prophetic in that they talk, if it's a organization that has churches and they represent churches, they should be able to speak prophetically on things the Bible is very clear about. But the Bible doesn't get into specific policy things on immigration. You have examples in the Old Testament. These are principles, though.
Man, if you want to take those ones.
What?
I would totally sign up for the biblical Old Testament.
They always want to treat them
like the sojourner. Like, okay, so they can't come into church and
they can be perpetual slaves.
They can be slaves forever. Okay, all right.
Not the native, though. Yeah, we can have usury against them. I agree. If you want to just be prophetic and stay within ecclesiastical bounds, what can churches positively do? There's only two things that a church can do, or Christians in a church, okay? When it comes to their in their capacity as church members, not political members, sorry, but church members. There's two things. Number one, you can provide care. There's obviously problems with that whole system with organizations like World Vision and
ERLC.
They're resettling refugees that have basically become illegal migrants. There's a whole problem with that, but you can be involved with that. And I think if it's legal and everything, okay, maybe who do you want doing that? Okay. But the other thing they didn't address in that particular resolution was you should be reporting.
There's nothing about Romans 13. There's nothing about,
report to them to ICE. encourage them to obey the law before you do it, obviously. But
it'd be a great resolution if somebody wants to write it.
Yeah. But that's the thing that, practically speaking, as a church, you can do.
Resolution on the prophetic support of immigration customs enforcement. That would go over really well.
Some of these resolutions, you're like, man, I don't know. I don't know. The Southern Baptist Convention has been doing this for a long time, getting involved in these policy positions. I just think you have to be careful because these things are hyper specific to certain time periods, and the church is pronouncing very universal principles from Scripture that apply to all peoples. So I'm not saying it's wrong to do these resolutions.
It's kind of like the Senate. You see the headline: Senate votes to condemn anti-Semitism. You're like, okay, great. What does that mean?
What does that even mean?
Okay, you don't like it.
And then there's all these guys online that start saying, it's illegal to say what I'm saying right now.
It didn't mean anything.
It was a resolution.
It's just a bunch of people decided we should say this.
In Florida, you can't say this. So they type something anti-Semitic, quote unquote, and you're like,
No one's coming.
No one's coming, dude.
Now, if you were in England, they would come. But thank goodness we're not in England.
We're not in England. Yeah. Well, the resolution on anti-Semitism just needed to be clearer. You didn't really know what it was. It was like, it's conspiracies. Okay, but what does that mean exactly? I said in the podcast when I talked about this stuff that if you just said unequal weights and measures towards Jewish people, lying about them, treating them differently than other groups because they're Jewish, they didn't have that language in there though. It was like, we reject the conspiracy theories. And there was actually a lady who did pipe up, a young lady, I was surprised, who went to the mic. She was very nervous, and she said, reject this resolution because, look, Jews can sin just like everyone else, and we don't know what you mean. And I was like, yeah, she's actually kind of right about this. As much as I don't like to see the craziness online.
I don't know if you saw this, but there was a business item that I believe was just, they just rejected it, the committee rejected it, but it was... it was a resolution to create a task force to assess messenger support for Israel. And I was like, who suggested that, and which side were they even from? I was trying to figure that one out, but they just rejected that one.
Okay.
But there were several task forces that could have been that were not. I'm guessing that happens every year.
Yeah. Well, those are kind of my thoughts.
I have one thought.
Yeah.
Or I guess one concluding thought that. Probably, I don't know if anybody else noticed it or thought it was significant, but there's a gentleman who does all the election directions. So he comes out, he's a fairly short guy. He comes out, I don't know if you saw him when you were there, but he's got glasses and he comes out. And everybody goes wild. I can't remember his name off the top of my head.
I can't either. I know you're talking about.
But he comes out, and actually that's probably the best part of the convention, is that like whenever he's the mascot of the SBC and he comes out and everybody's like, "Woo!" Like he's just giving you directions. He's like, "Hello, everybody." And so everything at the meeting is very tightly controlled, and I think Clint Presley actually did a really good job of moderating. He was pretty to the point overall. So everything's very controlled, and the time and everything. But this one guy who gives the directions, because there's these little pockets of time where people are voting and doing different things, he just starts talking sometimes. He just starts saying things. And he actually said something that I thought was quite profound, and I think maybe people missed it, but I thought... I was like, if you take the whole tenor of this convention and put it into one thing, what he just said, it was right there. Well, people call him the mayor because he's like the mayor. Everybody knows him. Everybody loves him. He's always walking around. Everyone's like, "Oh, yeah, there he is. We love him." And he said, people call me the mayor, but I actually am a mayor. And it turns out he is the mayor of the town of Ozark. I'm not 100% sure if that's Ozark, Alabama or Ozark, Arkansas. I think it's Ozark, Arkansas. But he said, "I actually am the mayor." And then he just said, and it was like just 10 seconds, but he just said, "And I really encourage Christians, and especially Southern Baptists, to get involved in your community and take those positions. And, you know, and try to seek out and try to change your community for the better." And I thought, that's it right there. Like, he actually said it. And in a way, the whole convention... You know, obviously William Wolfe and John Whitehead and a lot of the people who have been with the Center for Baptist Leadership, in many ways I think they were vindicated for, you know, the attitudes of people who are like, "Why are you guys bothering? There's no point. Just, you know, give up." I was that person until recently. I was the person saying that. So I think I have the credibility to say this, but they were vindicated in that. They kept working at it. They kept trying. They kept...
Well, Josh Abitoy called me in like 2021 or 2022. And he was like, "Hey, we want to put some effort towards SBC reform. What do you think? The woman pastor issue." And I just told him, I was so blackpilled at the time. I was like, "Won't work. That's not what gets the messengers motivated. We would have had to focus on the CRT thing or the abuse thing. And that hasn't been working out. The leaders that, for whatever reason, the leaders that... we're trying to do something about that, maybe didn't hit it as hard enough, or, you know, it's easy to armchair general. I don't really know completely why it didn't work out, but I always thought that that was more the thing that would get, because that was messing with people's real lives. The woman pastor thing was kind of a tangential issue, but you know what? The woman pastor thing, I think, has become kind of like it's all of those issues. Like, it's not about the woman pastor issue anymore.
It's about biblical fidelity.
It's a battle for the Bible, but it's about all those previous issues. It's basically saying, like, let a referendum on the CRT stuff, the Me Too stuff, because that's the battle that's being fought right now. Those battles already were fought, and I think there's some people with buyer's remorse, and, like, this is the battle, and they're like, "You know what? I let him get away with those. I'm not letting him get away with this." And this has a broader appeal in the sense of... there's just more people that you can get on board for this because it was an issue the conservative resurgence fought for and won already. But for the actual hardcore conservatives, like, I think that's why they became motivated towards it more. It was like, this is the only issue that is in town right now, and it sort of carried the weight of all these other issues. So anyway, I told Josh last night, I said, "Remember when you called me?" He's like, "Yeah, and I told you that I didn't think it would work, and, you know, you keep trying the same strategy, and it's like you're not gonna get." I even said, like, I don't see any way to win the room. You got to bring your friends." Which in this case, actually, they did bring friends. That was probably part of the issue. You can't win this from the inside. You can't turn. I mean, at the time, he's telling me names of people that are with them. I'm not gonna say the names, but I'm like, "Those guys aren't with you. Those guys are, you know, they're on the wrong side and stuff." And I told him last night, "Josh, you were somewhat right in the sense of, like, that issue did become a big rallying cry. And I got totally on board with it and really, you know, pumped up the gas this year on it." And also, it was a guy from the establishment, a former establishment guy in the SBC who ended up being a turncoat on him, in the good way. And and he won. It wasn't a dark horse who brought his friends. It was a guy that the Lord, I think, convicted. He repented. Willie Rice also, from what I understand, has a very conservative elder board at his church. And I mean, it's a good situation. And he already had a lot of Florida guys who were loyal to him because they had seen his character. So I didn't see that coming, but the Lord can do anything. And he's not done with the Southern Baptist Convention, it seems. Just like, you know, when that bullet missed Trump's ear, I was kind of like, man, maybe we're done. And then you saw that and you're like, I guess the Lord's not done. So that's the encouraging thing to me, is like, when you think all is lost, there is this hope. And hopefully that continues. Hopefully this opportunity is not wasted. And the number one thing in my mind right now is just pastors to get involved. This can't be political wonks, podcasters, and people who are motivated by the politics of it. There needs to be a lot more young men. I didn't see a lot of them there this year. I don't know if you noticed that. It's like, it seemed like a lot of the guys...
The young men are definitely bent in the missions direction. You see a lot more young men in that.
But young conservative guys, like it seemed like the young guys were in their 30s. Like I didn't see 20-something-year-olds.
No.
And the Zoomers have the opportunity now. Like they.
But it is Florida.
And it's hard to get here. You got to get a ticket. But if you're a Zoomer in a Southern Baptist church, have a conversation with your pastor. Say, I want to be a messenger. And you can be part of something bigger. And you can also bring some of that energy and that gravitas. If you're someone who loves the Lord and knows how to connect to the soul of the messengers with, hey, this is about the Lord. And I just think that that's what's needed now. So anyway, that's, yeah, some synopsis about the Southern Baptists. And it was interesting to see how the sausage is made in the convention center. And so easy to see how people can be manipulated from the stage. I heard for years, they run the whole thing from the stage. It's hard to like organize and fight back. And I was in the room and I thought, yep, that's exactly right. They do control everything up there. So
they control a lot, but it is, you know, just the fact that anybody can go up and talk gives an opportunity that doesn't exist in a lot of others.
You just got to out-organize the other factions that are also trying to get
political.
To the mics.
It's political. There's a political... But it worked, and I guess that's the thing that... I don't know. For me, that's the major takeaway. There's a lot of people blackpilling right now about whatever. They're looking for any excuse to just, oh, we're done, we're finished. And if you want to look at the world that way, it's very easy to do. You can do that. But if you believe that God's in control and that he has a special task for you to do, and you start looking at things in that way, then you're, you know, prepared to be more optimistic and excited about what he might do through you. Mm-hmm. And it might be the mayor of Ozark.
So I'm been in the Southern Baptist mindset for a few days. I haven't really paid attention to politics more broadly. Usually I speak to those issues too. But this, I've been seeing all over X this Anthony, what's his
Carmelo.
Carmelo Anthony thing. Was there a verdict? I don't even know.
Yeah, so he was given, I believe, 34 or 37 years. It was 30-something years with the possibility of parole halfway, which... So he'll probably be in prison for, I don't know, 17 years.
That's a good thing.
That's a good thing. I mean, I think Matt Walsh had tweeted something about it and said basically, like, this is not the just result. Like,
well, of course not.
But in, you know, in today's climate and, like, what we've seen over the last few years, we should be very grateful that this actually happened. Now, that didn't stop people from going absolutely nuts and, like...
Because it wasn't enough.
Well, because, I mean, there was even, like, people were sending me videos and stuff of folks, like, walking around and, like, looking for the jurors. And, like, even there was one guy who walked up to a guy and said, you were a juror, and, like, punched him in the face. And so they're...
Wait, from what angle, though? Because it was too harsh or not harsh enough?
Because he was... Because he wasn't let off. Because he was...
Oh, these are BLM guys.
Yeah, these are the BLM.
Those are the guys going crazy.
Yeah, yeah. There's nothing from the other side.
That makes more sense.
There never is anything from the other side. It's just always going in one direction.
Except maybe a few tweets or...
I stab you, and then I get mad at you.
You said a word. You said a word, and I was mad, and now I killed you, and I'm justified. Yeah. It was the same thing with this, the thing that happened in England.
He said a mean word.
He said... Yeah, what was the guy's name? Yeah, I talked about it on the podcast.
Noah.
Yeah, he was...
Henry Noah.
That's absolutely insane. And to see all these, like...
Well, and then that was the only one, because then, like, a couple days later, there's this guy like trying to behead the guy in the streets in Ireland. I don't know if you saw that.
I didn't. Oh, I saw there were riots. I didn't know what it was about though.
Because I think it was a Sudanese or a Somali or something, like tried to cut a guy's head off in the street, like just grabbed this guy, held him down, tried to cut his head off. He survived, but he gouged his eyes out, at least one of his eyes. And he was arrested, but that's why there's rioting in Belfast, because those Irish don't take as kindly. They're a little more they're used to partisanship and stuff like that.
Yeah, and this is sort of the danger zone for how we act accordingly when we see these very unjust things happen, and it's totally messed up, totally unjust. The danger zone, I think, is to sort of do exactly what BLM does. I don't see that happening a lot. Like, we're not as organized, meaning we as in, like, more conservative people, people who are pro-Western civ, people who nativists, and people who don't think white people are the devil, you know, and think that they deserve the same kinds of civil rights protections and so forth. Those people generally do not take to the streets and riot, but there is an ascending generation now, and I know at least online you see it. You saw it with that mosque shooting a few weeks ago. I read that whole, what do they call it, the message they put
manifesto.
Out there, manifesto.
Yeah. They're disconnected from the religion of nonviolence.
Right, so what they've said is that, in that, and I've heard this all online a lot, is we can't live like this. We have there is no political solution. We have a genocide against white people going on. If you believe those three things, what's the natural outcome? If you have no political options, but you can't live like this.
Flee or fight, that's it.
That's it. You either have to get away from these population centers and these countries where you have violence and unjust things happening to white males in particular, or you have to basically go to war. And the thing is, like, I've been watching the reaction to BLM. Like, what was waking a lot of people up to, hey, this woke stuff went too far? Well, the largest insurance payout, and I've said before, and I need to correct this, I think I've said it's been larger than hurricanes. I don't think it's larger than most of the big hurricanes, but if you take natural disasters off the table, the BLM riots, other than natural disasters, was the largest insurance payout. Any other riot, the Watts riot, anything else was smaller. That's what I think convinced people, because it affected their real lives. And they're like, wait a minute. Kind of like gay marriage now. It's like, you just said it wasn't going to affect me. And now my children are being trans. Like, that's when people get upset. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is we still have to believe God's in control. We have to use force when necessary and in just ways when it's called upon. We defend people, obviously. If I saw that guy cutting off, you know, someone's head in the streets, you're going to go and you're going to fight. But at the same time, we don't become a mob. And we do channel this energy into politics. That might even be, and we're not quite, I don't know how this would work, but like during the American Revolution, they had committees of correspondence they formed. They had like literally an organized shadow government. So it wasn't a mob. It was, we are recognizing the social leaders in our communities, that these are the rightful leaders. So it's legitimate authority. And I think you have to channel whatever energy is into legitimate authority that's recognized. Otherwise, yeah, you're going to get the worst kinds of things happening.
Yeah, and Rupert Lowe, I think, in England has been...
He's the man.
That's. I mean, I remember seeing his video and just being like...
There's somebody
who actually is saying... I will take, nobody will take responsibility. I will take responsibility. If you follow me, then we will end this nightmare. And people are flooding to it because, from what I understand, because
yes.
They just want somebody that will take responsibility.
He came out like the adult in the room. That's what it looked like. Like, you kids are all, you know, saying things and doing things that don't matter. Like, I'm an adult here. We're going to put an end to it. And that is what it takes. So... hang in there, you know, keep going. Even though you see these unjust things, have some righteous indignation, but then go get to work in very positive, constructive ways, because there's plenty of areas to get involved with. Don't sit on your computer and black pill. Show up at the Southern Baptist Convention, become the mayor of your town, whatever it takes to roll back some of the evil that's out there. So, yeah, that's about it. I don't think I have anything more to say, but appreciate you guys listening, and hopefully this was helpful. And God bless. Bye.